Hello there, this is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. This is a great show. I mean, we got everything in this show. In the next few weeks, Kansas may get a new senator, a new governor, and its first World Series title since 1985. All right. There are plenty of Royals fans from the Show Me State of Missouri as well. And later this hour, a new documentary from the journalist Edward Snowden came to blow his historic whistle on the NSA surveillance of Americans. Laura Poitras. She got the story and is part of it as well. It's a very interesting story, and she will come clean on all of that. And we'll take a look at the biggest science fair project in the history of civilization, the Mars Curiosity rover, and the chief engineer who built it. Man, there's a guy in love with a machine. You'll hear it later this hour. But first, Kansas has elected Republicans to the Senate in every race since 1939. But hello, there's an independent candidate, Greg Orman, in a near tie with the incumbent, Republican Senator Pat Roberts. In the governor's race, a Democrat, Paul Davis, is lapping at the heels of Republican incumbent Sam Brownback. And Republican Secretary of State Kris Kobach is neck and neck with his Democratic opponent, Gene Shodorf. Dave Helling, politics reporter for the Kansas City Star. Are we in Kansas anymore, buddy?
Sometimes, John, it's hard to tell. Between the Royals being in the World Series and Republicans competitive for the governor's race and the Senate race and even the Secretary of State's race, perhaps we are over the rainbow just a little bit. We'll know in a couple of weeks, I guess.
You'll notice I didn't use that phrase you all hate out there, what's the matter with Kansas, right?
Right. Well, and the Oz references get a little tired as well, but we'll take it. It's a very unusual political season in this state, and we're all trying to figure out sort of what the voters are telling us and which way they might be leaning, and with a little more than 2 weeks to go before Election Day, we just don't know.
You know, we talked on this program yesterday in our politics special about states that seem to be moving from red to blue. I don't know if that's the case in Kansas. This is much more candidate-driven, wouldn't you say?
Kansas is not turning blue, not by a long shot. It's one of the most Republican and frankly, one of the most conservative states, John, in the country. There are unique circumstances in this race. Pat Roberts, the incumbent senator, has been in Washington as a member of Congress since 1981. And you do get the sense that there is, at least among independents and Democrats, some fatigue at Roberts' long service in Washington, and that is helping Greg Orman. Now, were Greg Orman a Democrat on the ballot, he might be trailing by 5 or 6 points. But as an independent, he's been able to make the argument that I, in essence, can go to Washington and be a broker between the two parties. And with the disgust at Congress as high as it is, that really does have some resonance out here. And that's really the source of his strength. Now, you know, Roberts has done his best to sort of say, no, Greg Orman, you're a liberal Democrat, you're an Obama clone. And he's gotten some traction with that. He was trailing 7 or 8 points just a couple of weeks ago. Now it's closer to a 2 or 3 point race. So we'll see what happens in the last 2 weeks. But that's been the effort by the Roberts campaign to, in essence, say that this independent Greg Orman is really a liberal Democrat in disguise.
You know, that's a pretty sophisticated campaign strategy. Are Kansas voters really conscious of the potential for Orman to be a broker? I mean, to really go in there and be the kind of Anthony Kennedy swing voter in this very, very divided U.S. Senate?
It's very difficult. You know, Orman's campaign challenge has been immense, John, because as you might imagine, as an independent, he has to sort of walk a very, very careful middle road. If he attacks Pat Roberts too much, he becomes a Democrat. He becomes just like them. He's another symptom of the problem in Washington. And so he's had to be sort of level-headed, quiet, aggressive, but not too aggressive. And then he's asking voters to really take a hard look at his candidacy, to judge him issue by issue, rather than the typical case, which would be, I'm a Democrat, I believe certain things, and my opponent believes other things. So it's a very sophisticated, difficult path that voters in Kansas, at least in the Senate race, will have to pursue. And I think that's why you still see some undecideds, and why the last 2 weeks are going to be so important in this campaign.
So are the 6 or 7 Democrats in the state believing that he will caucus with the Democrats? And has Orman kept his cards face down on the table, or is he really saying to the Democrats, don't count on me, don't count on me?
No, I think it's a little bit of both. The cards are definitely face down. And we've tried 100 different ways to ask Orman the question, who will you caucus with? And he just won't answer, I think, because he wants to leave his options a bit open if he is elected to the Senate. So, but I do think that Kansans generally understand that his political viewpoints are more Democratic than they are Republican. He supports same-sex marriage, for example. He's pro-choice. He has given donations to Democrats in the past, although he's also given a few dollars to Republicans. So I think the general sense is that Greg Orman is understood to be more moderate, certainly to the left of Pat Roberts. But you know, how the Senate organizes itself is still outside of the grasp of most voters out here.
What happened to Brownback? I mean, he's got the conservative credentials that are absolutely crystal clean. I mean, what happened here?
Well, a very different dynamic in the governor's race in Kansas. You mentioned in your introduction that Kansans have sent Republicans to the Senate for 80 years. That isn't going to change, by the way. But Kansans do elect Democrats as governor on occasion because the criteria for a good governor is different than that from a senator. You get the sense that Kansans out here want their governors to be able to execute government, make sure the schools are open, make sure the roads are paved. And about 3 years ago, Governor Sam Brownback embarked on a very aggressive program of tax reduction in Kansas. He cut individual income tax rates dramatically. He eliminated taxes for most small businesses, income taxes. And that has blown a rather significant hole in the state's budget. And he's in trouble here primarily because Kansans don't, the ones who are, you know, not supporting his candidacy don't believe that his so-called experiment is working, and they're willing and have shown in the past an ability to consider a Democratic alternative. In this case, it's Paul Davis.
And, of course, in Kansas, there's the huge question of does a Democrat or a Republican in that Secretary of State's office get to choose the color of the license plate there? Dave Helling, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Dave Helling is politics reporter for the Kansas City Star. Thanks again.
My name's Ed Snowden. I'm 29 years old. I work for Booz Allen Hamilton as an infrastructure analyst for NSA in Hawaii.
More than a year ago, Booz Allen Hamilton whistleblower Edward Snowden changed everything at the National Security Establishment, informing the world about how the NSA can watch basically all of us.
The NSA specifically targets the communications of everyone. It ingests them by default. It collects them in its system, and it filters them, and it analyzes them, and it measures them, and it stores them for periods of time, simply because that's the easiest, most efficient, and most valuable way to achieve these ends.
Snowden reached out to journalists to publish his information. Among them was documentary filmmaker Laura Poitras. Snowden and Poitras only communicated through encrypted emails. Snowden used the name Citizen 4. Here is Poitras reading one of those first emails.
You asked why I picked you. I didn't. You did. The surveillance you've experienced means you've been selected. A term which will mean more to you as you learn about how the modern SIGINT system works. For now, know that every border you cross, every purchase you make, every call you dial, every cell phone tower you pass, friend you keep, article you write, site you visit, subject line you type, and packet you route is in the hands of a system whose reach is unlimited, but whose safeguards are not.
Just the start of the story of Citizen 4, a new documentary released in theaters October 24th about the state of American values in the face of terror.
I mean, I would argue that, you know, the U.S. response to the attacks has led us into a world that I think has less security. You know, increased secrecy, increased sort of executive power. We have secret interpretations of laws. We have, I mean, all these things where we sort of drifting away of what I think are core principles of the country, which are, you know, democracy and rule of law. All those kinds of things seem to have been put at risk in the name of national security, which, I mean, I would argue hasn't been achieved.
Put at risk or eradicated? I mean, are we a constitutional democracy?
I mean, on one hand, I would say, you know, so I'm a journalist and I've been reporting on these issues, and I don't feel that I'm in danger to, you know, my freedom of expression. I'm still able to do my work. However, I have been put on a watch list. I have been detained at the border countless times. I've, you know, relocated to Berlin so that I could protect source material. I mean, these kinds of things are disturbing. I mean, I've been working with Jim Risen on some stories in the New York Times, and he's facing subpoenas. So we are seeing a definite war on whistleblowers, war on leakers, war on anyone who wants to talk about some of issues that the government wants to maintain a secret from the public. And I think what Snowden believed and why he did what he did is that these issues are issues that the public should know about. If the government is engaging in this kind of suspicionless mass surveillance, the public has a right to know.
This film, Citizen Four, opens in a very Dr. Strangelove kind of conference. You've got a fellow by the name of William Binney, who's in many ways responsible for a lot of the technology that's behind the Snowden leaks, talking regretfully about what he came up with in that situation. And here he is on this stage with this giant sort of IMAG picture of him. It's very chilling.
Yeah, I mean, you know, William Binney, I think of him sometimes as a bit of an Oppenheimer-type character. I mean, somebody who is the architect of mass surveillance, and then seeing the tools that he'd created to, you know, fight against the Cold War being sort of turned inward onto the United States. And so you see the kind of regret. He's also a whistleblower. So he, you know, immediately after 9/11, when the National Security Agency started spying on Americans, he, you know, he immediately went to his superiors and said, what are we doing? This is unconstitutional.
He says it very clearly at the top of your documentary. He says they made a decision after 9/11 to spy on everybody.
Right. Yeah.
You believe that's true? We're all being spied on.
Well, I believe that in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, yeah, they did turn their what they pointed out to the rest of the world, what the NSA looked at in terms of foreign intelligence gathering, they turned inward into the United States.
He regrets.
Right. I mean,
completely.
William Binney. I mean, the thing about William Binney is he, you know, blew the whistle, tried to work internally to raise awareness about NSA spying, and then he and three other colleagues ended up under investigation. So you have a situation where you have a three-decade veteran of the NSA, who was a technical director, having FBI agents show up at his house with guns.
What character of Snowden comes out in this film? You warned him of what was going to happen here as his story is told.
Sure. I mean, you know, in our correspondence, at some point, I think it was in April 2013, he communicated that his identity would be revealed when these disclosures came forward, and he said that he didn't want to hide, but he never wanted to be the center of attention. And when he told me that his identity would come forward, I said, then I want to meet with you and I want to film you, because I think it's important that you say what your motivations are and not leave that up to the press. And then he eventually agreed, which is how it was that we ended up in Hong Kong. I mean, I think that he's been very consistent in, you know, why he's done what he's done, you know, which is that he feels that, you know, these programs are a threat to democracy and that the public has a right to know what their government is doing. And when we met in Hong Kong, I mean, the greatest sense we had was that he had made a decision that he knew would unravel his life, but that he had done it because he felt it was of great public importance.
Did he really think that he wasn't going to be the story here, either in terms of the way the media was going to jump on this or the way that you would end up telling this story?
That was his intention. I think he really felt that he would be a distraction from the issues, so he wanted to be as, you know, background as possible. I mean, when the first stories were published, you see, so there's a Verizon story and there's a Prism story. You know, the media and the response was focused on the issues. And as soon as he was identified, it became about him. And I think he foresaw that. In terms of, you know, working with me, I mean, I don't think he reached out to me because I'm a filmmaker. He reached out to me because I was working on the topic of surveillance and because I actually had the skills, technical skills.
We see Snowden in Moscow at the end of the film. Is he weary? He certainly has been reunited with his partner, which would improve morale, I suspect.
Yeah.
What do you think his state is at this
point? I mean, I think actually, you know, I've made a few trips to Moscow to see him, and there's a kind of innocence that we experienced in this hotel room in Hong Kong, which is, here's somebody who's never spoken to any journalist, and I've seen over time that there's you know, all the sort of pressures of the of the world, kind of, you can feel it on him. But I think he's, you know, with now that Lindsay's there, I think he's in much better spirits.
At the end of the film, there's a couple of things that are pretty surprising. Number one, there's a scene that gives a feeling of the scale of the number of people being watched. And then there's a suggestion that Snowden isn't the end in terms of a channel for this information. Can you elaborate on any of that?
Sure. I mean, I'm not going to go into lots of details about sort of source, but what I think I wanted to communicate with the film is that it's about people who, you know, take courageous positions to come forward and share information. And there have been multiple sources. And Snowden is not the, you know, not the first and not the last person who's, you know, sacrificed to reveal information to the public. So that's the note in which we end on.
You have a source higher up than Snowden.
I'm not going to comment on, you know, where he is in the government.
Well, Snowden seems to be impressed with the source, as you noted in a handwritten note passed to Snowden.
Yeah, you see that.
What do you hope is the outcome of Citizen 4? What do you hope is the reaction, the reception?
You know, it's a film, it's both about NSA surveillance and the dangers of NSA surveillance, you know, globally, but it's also really a film about, you know, journalists and sources who take extraordinary risks. And I think it's also a film that's about people who stand up in the face of wrongdoing and put themselves on the line. So I think that for people to share that, I mean, that's, as a filmmaker, I mean, I'm interested in telling narratives and stories that, you know, connect to people emotionally.
Laura Poitras, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Laura Poitras is the director of the documentary film Citizen 4 about Edward Snowden and the revelations that have changed so much in America. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Another little thought about the Watergate era. Our friends at The Retro Report note that the Titanic struggle and electoral controversy over campaign finance this year, there's $1 billion on the block for this midterm election. It all stems from 1972 and Watergate, that third-rate burglary that ended Richard Nixon's presidency, found that the committee to reelect the president had received tens of millions of dollars in secret campaign donations. Here's former White House counsel John Dean, who served 4 months in prison for his role in covering up the scandal.
They had literally stacks and stacks of cash sitting around. They couldn't count it as fast as it was coming in.
Uh-oh. Well, in 1974, Congress acted to supposedly rid secret money from campaigns.
The Federal Campaign Act of 1974 is going to change American politics forever, and hopefully for the better.
We thought that we got what we needed. I felt we had achieved a very, very historic reform.
But it was more of a dream for Fred Wertheimer there, who was the head of Common Cause. Common Cause, of course, which exposed all those secret donations. Today, if anything, the influence of money has exploded since then. Retro Report producer Scott Michaels tells us the story. Scott, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
It's amazing of how convinced they were that they were fixing the system, and anything but that happened since then.
Yeah, I mean, the law that came out of Watergate really was, it was a landmark reform of the campaign finance system, and it set up the foundation for our modern system of campaign finance fundraising. What we've seen 40 years later is that really much of that law has been undercut at this point.
And part of it had to do with the law bumping into various other kinds of legal controversies. Here's another scandal that prompted the next major reform movement. Here's Senator John McCain.
The President of the United States took the Lincoln bedroom, treated it like Motel 6, and he was the bellhop.
John McCain, of course, talking about President Clinton hosting donors at the White House to raise so-called soft money for the 1996 reelection campaign. McCain, of course, decided to take the lead and create another reform movement. What happened there?
So John McCain took the lead in trying to ban what was called soft money. And soft money was the big way that money got into the political system in the 80s and 90s. And basically, it was a way to get around the law that had been passed after Watergate.
But then all of this got kicked into the Supreme Court, and we're back to an issue of where speech is money, money is speech, and the Citizens United era, of course, is where we are now. Here's Fred Wertheimer, who pretty much says that we're back where we started.
What was at the core of the Watergate campaign finance scandals? Corporate money, secret money, unlimited contributions from individuals. What do we have today? corporate money, secret money, unlimited contributions from individuals.
How come public outrage hasn't generated more of a sense of we need to fix this?
Well, I mean, I think Fred Wertheimer would say that there really hasn't been a scandal the way that there was during the Watergate era that has really captured the public imagination and led to reform, and that there's been a cycle over the last 40 or 50 years of scandal and reform and scandal and reform. But that many of the elements that were present in the 1970s that led to the scandal are back in the system now, where it's as easy as ever to spend money and to spend money secretly and for wealthy corporations and unions to get money into the political system.
What it seems to me is that those players really enjoy this new game of being able to play super PAC influence, and that until there is a huge scandal where essentially a presidential candidate is bought, we're not going to see any reform. Is that pretty much your conclusion at Retro Report?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's unlikely that we're going to see a major kind of reform like we did after Watergate. And part of that is because of the way the Supreme Court has ruled and the fact that all of this is tied up with the First Amendment. So to pass a law like that, you would really have to pass a constitutional amendment, which seems unlikely to happen.
Scott Michaels, producer at Retro Report, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
The weather report on Mars, partly cloudy with a chance of a comet. There was an 87,000-mile near miss this week. Three orbiters had to duck for cover. From the first missions past Mars during the 1960s to the 2012 launch of the Mars Curiosity rover, we have had a connection to the red planet here on Earth. Rob Manning is the former chief engineer for the Curiosity rover, the most complicated engineering challenge ever attempted for a planetary landing. He tells his story in Mars Rover Curiosity, an inside account from Curiosity's chief engineer. There's a lot of science in exploring Mars, but nothing is possible until the engineers get everything right. And Manning led the team that made it all possible.
Earth and Mars are very different. First of all, although Mars is smaller than Earth and has a lower gravity than Earth, it's got an atmosphere just like Earth, except it's only 1% as thick. So unfortunately, you can't land a vehicle on Mars like you can land a vehicle on the moon, because if you try to just fire rockets backwards without a heat shield, and as you enter the atmosphere so fast, you would end up melting and your vehicle wouldn't make it to the surface. On the other hand, we could use the atmosphere just like we do on Earth to slow down. And so we use a heat shield to do that. And we also can use parachutes just like we do on Earth to slow down even more. And we do that, and that those parachutes can get us down from a whopping 1,000 miles an hour down to 200 miles an hour. But because the air is so thin, I mean, that's faster than a person who leaps out of an airplane on this planet without a parachute. And the ground is really close. So you have to do more. So you have to convert yourself into a lunar lander with rockets firing backwards to slow yourself down. And so all of our vehicles we've sent to Mars always all had to contend and do those same steps, a heat shield, a supersonic parachute, and then finally use some sort of rocket.
Curiosity had to land like a rocket. It was simply too big to just drop with airbags and a parachute. So a new system was developed that there would be no chance to test until they got to Mars, when it had to work the first time.
We felt that we were stuck. So in the process of figuring out what to do, a couple of us got together and we brainstormed ideas how to do it. And one of the ideas that popped up is to turn the lander and rover upside down and put a jetpack on a rover and lower it to the surface of Mars on ropes. And so we finally said, hey, let's just try this idea out. It sounds silly at first, but you know, we use ropes to land Pathfinder and Spirit and Opportunity on Mars. They were lowered down on a long bridle. Although the airbags were surrounding them, the rovers, there were rockets up above. So we said, well, won't we just steal that same idea, change from solid rockets to liquid rockets, and then instead of being really rough about it and bouncing, we'll do is we'll control the speed and the velocity just right so when it lands, it can just land really slow, just like the Sikorsky helicopters, the Sky Crane helicopter that can land payloads with a helicopter on ropes with incredible, exquisite precision.
But there's this one engineering problem that just seems to typify engineering everywhere, universally. You needed to figure out when to throw away the rocket holding the ropes, right?
Yeah. Yes,
and
we did.
Because if the rocket didn't know that the lander had landed, that the rover had landed,
it would just continue thrusting and the rockets could just destroy everything, right?
Yeah, that would be kind of embarrassing.
And you worked on this and worked on this for so long until there was an unbelievably simple answer to this problem.
It really was. And it kind of, you know, we're almost embarrassed that we didn't think of it earlier. But my friend Miguel San Martin suddenly realized that after struggling to figure out how to know when the rover was on the ground, Miguel said, hey, you know what? If you're coming down, lowering the rover on the rope, and we call it the descent stage, the thing that's above the rover, while we're doing this called the sky crane maneuver, where we're lowering the rover down and slowly, 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 the wheels make contact. But the descent stage keeps its motion downward. And so we have a control software that's keeping that velocity at a constant rate going down. But once the rover's on the ground,
it's no longer heavy. It's no longer pulling.
Exactly. It's no longer pulling. So all we have to do is the software has to ask the controller, hey, how much throttle are you doing now? Have you reduced it yet? And the answer is, yep, it's a lot lighter now, but I'm still coming down for you. Okay, you can stop now. We're on the ground. And so the rover sends a little message to the descent stage. Okay, thank you very much. See you later. And it cuts the three cables, as well as electrical cable that goes up there. And the descent stage dutifully makes a little turn and flies off 600 meters to a rather sad ending.
And that was the thing you were most worried about when the whole thing landed, right?
Well, because that was one that was really difficult to test. I can take the rover, the actual real rover, in our clean room and run cables on the floor to the descent stage, which I did with our team. We did, and try that whole process of communication out. But I couldn't reproduce all the funny business of electrically getting the signals to be right, all the conditions to be right. I couldn't get the gravity to change. I couldn't get it to offload in the same way of a real touchdown. And so all these things we had to do through simulation. And I can tell you, having been involved in Pathfinder, Spirit, Opportunity, and Phoenix, it's always that way. There's a surreality of the whole thing until you see that picture. That picture just slaps you in the face and says, you know, we didn't make that up. That's real. And that relief just courses through your veins. And, you know, after so many years, over a decade of work, to see it all come true is just an amazing relief.
The book that you've written here, Mars Rover Curiosity, is such a tale of scientists wanting one thing and engineers saying maybe they can't do it. And the tension that comes from that, creative tension that comes from that. I'm just wondering, at the end of the whole thing, when you finally deliver a vehicle on these laboratories to the surface of Mars and the scientific information starts coming in, do those scientists come around and thank you? Or do they just go on with their work and all those guys, yeah, they put it on the
– oh,
we're doing the real work.
You know, I have had scientists come into my office and hug me. They are so grateful. I mean, for many of these people, they've been studying or wanting to know – details about a certain area of Mars for years and years and years. And suddenly we have been privileged to give them this information that they've dreamed about. I remember even back in the early 90s when one of the most inspiring things about my work, there's a gentleman by the name of Dr. Tim Parker, who is a geomorphologist, and his office is just next to mine. He told me he's been studying the Viking pictures for the last 15 years. He was one of the early people that said, you know, maybe Mars might have had an ocean. At the time, I thought he might have been a little bit off. But no, we believe it. We actually think that Mars really had shallow oceans over many parts of the planet long, long ago. Well, we now know that Mars was a wet and warm and habitable place for single-cell organisms to survive. You know, Mars has turned out to be a far more interesting place than even Tim Parker imagined back in 1993. And so I feel very privileged to have been part of the wonderful team of people who can actually bring this stuff to reality and to understand something, not just for them, but about ourselves. I mean, what we're really doing, think about this, what we're really doing is we're going out and looking to see whether the web of life that we are all part of, that goes back billions of years in this planet, has that web extended or come from other places like Mars? If the conditions are right on Mars, if they were right for life, and we now know they were at one time, why wouldn't life be there? Those are very profound questions that, you know, it really involve all of us.
Rob Manning, Mars rover, former chief engineer at the JPL Jet Propulsion Laboratory at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena. We'll be back on Earth tomorrow. Joining us, the Emmy Award-winning actor and comedian Jonathan Katz, who is no doctor, but perhaps he'll bring along therapist Dr. Katz to help us all through these difficult times. Be sure to join us. For the election season, we know you are way too intelligent to be swayed by super PAC attack ads, but we'll share some new and disturbing findings about the power of those ads. They work in close races and have been catching candidates for state and local judgeships. Citizens United Money takes on the electoral process. Thank you for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.